welcome to episode 13, season 2 of the Travels Through Time History Podcast. Hello, I'm Violet Moller. In this episode, we're going back to 1939, one of the most dramatic years of the 20th century. The Queen of Food Historians, Dr. Annie Gray, is going to take us behind the green baize door of No. 10 Downing Street to meet a remarkable woman called Georgina Landemar. Georgina worked as Winston Churchill's cook for over 15 years, and her fascinating life story is the subject of Annie's latest book, Victory in the Kitchen, which traces her meteoric career from teenage nursery maid to one of the most celebrated cooks in the whole country, an unheard of achievement for a working class woman at that time. They say an army marches on its stomach, and this was certainly true of Winston Churchill, who really loved his food. He was especially fond of beef, which he always ate rare and often for breakfast. So it is fitting that when I met up with Annie the other day at her publisher's, we were right next door to Smithfield Market, which has been the centre of the London meat trade for over 800 years. Annie has many strings to her bow. She's the resident expert on BBC Radio 4's The Kitchen Cabinet. She is a research associate at the University of York and the author of several best-selling books, including The Greedy Queen, about Queen Victoria's love of food.
Welcome to Travels Through Time, Annie.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we find out about Georgina's life, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how you found her and came to her as a subject.
I was in the unenviable position that authors sometimes drop into where they have to come up with an idea. And it's really hard to come up with a really good idea for a book because you want something that you can live with for over a year, writing it, researching it, and then later on publicising it. You want something that people will be interested in. And I write books for a general public who don't necessarily have specialist knowledge, who just want something that's going to be a cool read. They're not necessarily particularly even interested in the period. They just want something that's fun. And also, I'm a food historian and a social historian, so I sort of knew I wanted to write about food, obviously, and I kind of have this burning desire to write about women as well. I think women tend to be still very underrepresented in history writing, and especially when it comes to servants and below stairs lives, partly, I have to admit, because they're really hard to research. So I went to the Jane Grigson Library, which is in Oxford Brookes, and sort of stood there and hoped that something would jump off at the shelves. So they're going, oh, look, this is really interesting. This cookbook looks lovely. I don't know what I'm doing. And I came across Georgina's cookery book, which she wrote in 1958, Recipes from No. 10. I thought, this is really interesting. This is lovely. Put it back on the shelf. Thought, I'm sure someone's written about it, because quite obviously, Winston Churchill, there's loads of interest in him. This was quite clearly a key figure. Absolutely would have been covered. And it turned out that it hadn't. No one had written about Winston Churchill's domestic life. No one had written about his servants at all. There are 1,000 biographies of Winston Churchill, and very, very few of them even mention his servants, which I think is criminal, especially in this day and age, where really the wealth of historical material that is out there, new books all the time, really groundbreaking things like Hayley Ribbonhold's The Five, you know, showing that the lives of ordinary, in inverted commas, people are just as rewarding to read about and just as interesting as anything else. So I got in contact with Georgina's granddaughter, who is still alive, who is 76 and Britain's oldest Ironman competitor.
Wow.
So the genes run in the family. And she was delighted that I wanted to write about her nan. She said she'd tried but couldn't really get beyond really the starting block because there's so little information. I like a challenge. So I thought, this is brilliant. This is a life of a woman who is clearly at the top of her profession, who was quite groundbreaking because women at that point working at that level in cookery were relatively rare still. And it gave me a chance to talk about domestic service and 20th century food. So when I wrote about The Greedy Queen, some of that really was to talk about Victorian food and put that into perspective. And with this one, I also tell the story of 20th century food and the changes that happened. So it kind of rolled loads of things I wanted to write about into one.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful that you've you know, as you say, you found this sort of hidden female story of which there are millions in history, and telling this incredible woman's story. And I think there's a huge value in that domestic social history, which perhaps is coming to the fore now, but certainly previously it hasn't been focused on. It's mainly been the sort of politics and the big stories. So I think it's fascinating. One of the things I really loved about your book were the little details about Georgina's story that you put in. So that one that springs to mind is the German pastries filled with jam and cream, which her and her brother Algy would sneak off and spend their pocket money on, and they didn't admit to their parents for decades that they'd been
no. And
doing
then
this.
Algy used the same shop to cater his wedding, which was so perfect.
That's amazing. And of course, then you explain that there were lots of German bakeries in London in the 1880s, which I had absolutely no idea. All these bakers had fled the unrest in Germany in the 1870s and come. I just thought that was such a wonderful detail. And I wonder, going back to the point about this isn't big history, you can't just go to the calendar of state papers and kind of plot it. How on earth did you find the sources?
I have to say this was one of the most difficult things I've ever done. And conversely, of course, one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. I rather naively thought there would be lots of information because Churchill, there's a massive archive in Cambridge. Surely there would be loads of information there. And it turns out not only is there not very much information on servants in the Churchill archive, because a lot of it was edited before it was given over. So things like wage books are missing, menu books are missing. A lot of the sort of the stuff that would have been kept, the documents that certainly would have existed, just are no longer there. There's lots and lots of minutes of meetings and drafts and redrafts of letters to important men talking about important things to do with war, but very little to do with the people who are actually running the household.
And do you think that's because someone went through it and said, this isn't important stuff, we're going to throw it away and not
yes,
bother keeping
it? Yes, I do. I assume Clementine Churchill or possibly even Mary Soames, who went through the archive as well, decided what was and wasn't important. There may also have been a level of attrition at the time. I mean, one of the sources that was lovely to read were the menu ledgers that were kept, so a daily record of what was eaten. I used similar sources a lot for Greedy Queen, but in this case, there's one for 1937 to 1938. Nothing for the whole war, a staff menu book for 1946, and then the sort of sporadic bits in the 50s. So really, those would have existed, but they may just have been lost. You know, these are just tiny little exercise books.
Yeah, ephemera.
Yeah, that no one would have thought were interesting. I mean, you know, I managed to trace the cookery books that Clementine Churchill had on her own shelf through the notes that she'd made in those menu books. Those cookery books no longer exist. They may be on a shelf somewhere at Chartwell. They may just have got lost. You know, oh, well, let's give the archive all of these books that belong to Winston Churchill, the great man himself. But these ones, the domestic trivia, yeah, the fiction, the equivalent of the trashy crime fiction, no one's interested in that. You know, so there was a genuine way of curating Churchill's life after his death, and a really concerted effort to do that, I think, consciously or subconsciously. And that means that a lot of the stuff that I would have loved to have used just wasn't there.
That's really interesting. And I suppose it's all about Churchill rather than his wider family and household.
Yes, and even Clementine, his wife, almost deliberately sort of took herself out of that archive. So he's very much focused on Winston himself. Georgina was completely complicit in this. So when she wrote her cookery book in 1958, she didn't put herself in it at all. Modern cookery books, we are very used to them being sort of slightly autobiographical. So if you read a book by Nigel Slater in particular, yeah, Diana Henry, Catherine Phipps, any of these people who are writing brilliant cookery books, you read them and they'll say, well, I was doing this at this point, or I came up with this recipe because I used to live in wherever. So we're very used to that idea that a cookery book is also a storybook. Recipes from Number 10, Georgina has stripped herself out. There are no introductions to the recipes. They're just really basic prose, and you get almost no sense of character. So she was complicit in the fact that she's invisible in some ways. But it turns out, of course, no one's completely invisible. So she kept a memoir, which she wrote down in the 1970s. And then in 1978, she tore it up into little pieces and put it down the sink. Because her daughter, who was dying of breast cancer at the time, and her son-in-law told her life wasn't valuable. She was a servant who would be interested. And it was a horrible time in the household. Tensions were running very high, as you can imagine. And it was also indicative of an attitude in the 70s whereby domestic service, which so many people's parents and grandparents had been in, was regarded... It wasn't quite shameful, but there was this real tension around how you saw domestic service. Was it good? Was it bad? So she ripped up her memoir and put it down the sink, and 26 pages were saved by her granddaughter. but they only cover the first 13 years of Georgina's life. They're really good. Her memory was absolutely razor sharp. And bear in mind, she was 95 at the time. So there's that, which gives you a vague idea of the early part of her life. And then, of course, there's the usual official records like census data, electoral registers. She also recorded a programme with Joan Bakewell in the 1970s, 1976, I think it was. So there's 15 minutes of Georgina on screen talking about her life.
Oh, wow, so it's film, not radio.
No, this is for film. So she's there, and it's her birthday, and she's... You know, she's really, really reactionary by that point, as many old people are, but bright as a button and absolutely amazing to listen to. So there's that fragment where she's mainly talking about the war years. But it really was sort of CSI history with this, researching the life of someone who was working class, who was a woman. And actually, in some ways, the 20th century is more difficult than the 19th because, of course, we don't have access to the census data after 1911. Right. So that middle period of the century, she's virtually invisible. And it really was a question of teasing out tiny references in her manuscript recipe book that she kept and things like that. And I suppose a vast knowledge of food from that era and the aristocracy of that era, that was kind of crucial. So knowing that little tiny references could be extrapolated into longer paragraphs based on what was the norm for a cook, or in the case of Paul, her husband, for a chef in France.
Yeah, well, you did a very, very good job. It's a beautifully told story. And just to touch upon something that you mentioned then, Georgina was born in 1882, and so she lived through this period of enormous change, you know, two world wars, and enormous change in the number of people who worked in domestic service. And so when she was born in 1882, thousands of men and women and children worked for wealthier people in their houses. And as with other professions, children would often follow their parents in their parents' footsteps and get the same kind of jobs. And sometimes the same family would have worked for the rich family for generations, especially in rural areas. I think that's sort of fascinating how there was this connection. And Georgina's aunt was a lady's maid, and her father, Mark Young, was a coachman. So I suppose that for her, getting a job in service would have seemed quite natural, and she could also make use of their contacts. Can you just give us a brief overview of the trends of domestic service and how it would have been when she first started working, what kind of jobs there would have been, and how many people would have worked in different types of households?
I mean, I think the history of domestic service, especially when it comes to women, really is the history of women. Because if you were not a servant, you were probably a servant keeper. Very, very few women would have been neither at some point in their lives. So it's one of those things where that's like sort of saying summer office work today. It's a fascinating area. I mean, Georgina was born just at the point where domestic service was starting to be very problematic, where there were a lot more middle class families that wanted to employ servants, and where there was a lot of angst about servant keeping. And she was the last person in her family to go into domestic service. Her mother had been a kitchen maid, her father was a coachman. And one of the things I found fascinating actually researching the book were these networks, the way in which servants got into households. So in the village that she was born in, Oldbury, there were three or four crucial families, and then there were the Rothschilds down the road. And you could quite clearly see these networks building, and how people got employment was through these aristocratic connections, really.
Yeah, you mentioned that the aristocratic families would sometimes function as godparents, would stand as godparents to the village children.
Yeah, and then stand them in their first job or provide a reference. There's so much that isn't recorded about jobs, especially for girls, because the norm was that you would start as a day girl, you'd need to gain experience. So Georgina started, her first job was as a nursery maid for a family called the Gwynns, and she went off and did that for a bit, and then she came home again. So that it wasn't as if a girl left home and that was it, she's gone. They would gain experience in various different areas. And when she decided to become a kitchen maid, she must have been quite focused very, very early on, because she went straight into a household that employed six people in the kitchen.
Do you think she was already interested in cooking at that age? I mean,
she said she was.
Was there anyone who might have taught her how to
cook? Well, her mother had been a kitchen maid and clearly was a very good cook, because she wouldn't have worked your way up in that position otherwise. And I think she had this idea of some form of sort of hereditary idea of cooking. She was certainly interested in food, although the memoir, because it was written down at the end of her life, of course she's emphasizing the food bits in it because of what she's done for a job. So whether or not, as she says, when she's older, she was constantly thinking about food, about pastries, about coming home from school to get food at home and then going back to school and having the rest of the soup that the people who had food at school had, all of those things she talks about. But whether or not that's her looking back as a cook at her early age, or whether or not actually as a 9-year-old she was that obsessed is harder to tell. But she certainly felt that that was a thing she wanted to go into. And she must have felt that it was a thing she wanted to go into in quite a serious manner. Most girls, most servants worked in very small households. So 75% of the households that employed servants only employed one or two people. And that's your kind of norm in terms of servant keeping.
Right.
Then you've got the households who have, say, 4 or 5 servants who are kind of upper middle class. And you go up and up and up until you get to the royal household where there's hundreds. She started in one that was already very prestigious, and she never ever worked in small households. So she's already in the top 10% of servants. She's already working for very prestigious homes. She started as what she called number 6, so the scullery maid, and like all people in her profession, worked her way up steadily through the kitchen hierarchy, moving houses at each step of the way. It was very difficult to gain promotion within a house, because if you made cook somewhere where you'd been maid, you're not going to have any discipline. All the maids would be like, yeah, but you know, you were one of us 2 days ago. You were having midnight feasts and hanging out the window. So why are we going to obey you now? You're a cook. We know she worked for a really, really wealthy household in 1909, which was when she'd become cook at the age of 25. So it took her about 10 years to go from scullery maid to being cook. When she was made cook, she was cooking for sort of really nouveau riche families, so quite fussy cookery that would have been a blend of English and French cookery, mainly learnt from books and from experience. Lots of moulds, lots of fiddly
food. Yes, can you tell us about the mould? Because that was one of the things that, one of the recipes that made me laugh the most was jugged hair. A la surprise.
Yeah.
Surprise, I suppose. And then the first instruction is butter some hair. Yes. Moulds.
There is a picture of those.
Hair is H-A-R-E, by the way, for the listeners who are getting confused here.
It's brilliant.
Imagine that you have not just, I mean, perhaps rabbit moulds, but then hair also molds. Hair
very
molds.
Specific.
Yeah.
There are very specific moulds at that point. British cookery in the 19th century was really sort of divided between the very high-end stuff which you aspired to have, which was French. Absolutely. If you were an aristocrat, if you were titled, if you were wealthy, you employed a French male chef, and you probably paid them about 150 quid a year. And wow. They would cook French food in the French idiom that had French names. It was aggressively, you know, it was this French, that was it. All the restaurants served French food, employed French chefs. If you couldn't afford a French chef, you'd have a man who was English, but was probably still cooking predominantly French food. And then if you couldn't afford them, that's when you'd employ a woman who was probably on half or a third of the wages that you'd pay a man.
Nothing's changed.
Well, quite. And English women were still often called upon to cook high-end French food, but you had this kind of type of food called recherche cuisine in the Edwardian period and late Victorian period, and it covers a whole range of different things. But in the kind of milieu that Georgina was cooking in, this sort of very, very wealthy milieu, but new money, it was all about transforming the food. It had to look like nothing on earth. It couldn't possibly look like something that you'd ever see anywhere in a field or in a butcher's shop. So jugged hare a la surprise is cake. That's the surprise. I mean, wow, it's cake in a hare mold. And it's just, I mean, the recipe, all of the recipes from that particular style of cuisine go on and on and on for pages and involve patent mixtures and food colouring and essences.
Well, there was one describing mincing raw steak. I think it's called beef cake. So it doesn't sound very French. So you mince the steak and then you have to press it through a sieve. Yeah. Which
have you
just,
ever done it?
Of course not. I mean, it sounds impossible. How do you do it?
You develop really good shoulder muscles.
Yeah, you must do.
Cooks were renowned for having enormous biceps.
I mean, can you have a sieve with big holes in?
No, because then you don't get a mince, do you? It does take hours to put raw meat through a wire sieve, but that was the requirement, and that was the point, because
yeah.
If you were wealthy enough, you could afford 6
you
people
in
your kitchen.
You had enough people to
so they would
do the
that.
Work.
So it was incredibly physical, the work, and you showed your wealth by having all of these incredibly intricate, very expensive copper moulds.
So sort of style over substance.
Very much. If you were old money, you didn't bother with any of that, you just put half a sheep on the table.
Yeah.
Because then you were completely going against all of that and going, well, those people have got that, but I'm doing something which is 50 years ago is what we would have done.
Yeah, and sheep from your estate.
So how you display what you're eating on the table is very much tied up with not just class, but also how long you've had your money for and how long your pile has existed in the country for.
Yeah, fascinating. I think we should fast forward a bit now and get to your first scene. We are in the summer of 1939,
yes.
I think. and we're at a house called Exning House in Newmarket.
Yep.
So can you take us to Exning House and tell us what's happening there?
Exning House still exists. It's now private. It's a mixture of private flats and apartments. It is a beautiful arts and crafts house on one side and then a sort of Victorian house on the other. And in its day, it was owned by a man called Baron Glanley. William Tatum, and he was a racehorse owner. He was known as this huge sporting figure in Newmarket. Very, very wealthy, self-made man. Again, new money. And Georgina at this point was really at the peak of her career. So she had married in 1909, Paul, her husband. She'd trained at his side. She'd worked with him. They'd worked, I think, as jobbing cooks for most of his life. But he was much older than her, and he died in 1932, leaving her a widow. And she was only 50, and she had a daughter as well, Yvonne. So after his death, I mean, she wasn't going to retire. She's 50, she's working class, she's still young, she's just not in her thinking. So she became a jobbing cook. She became a cook for hire, and a very, very good one, because she had all of this English training. She now had this veneer of French training from Paul. She had a lot of connections as well. So she was cooking for things like debutante balls. She was cooking for coming out parties. She was doing stints, either sort of two or three nights for someone or one big party, or as with Baron Glanley, she was there for the season. So this was the racing season, and he'd hired her to cook for him instead of his normal cook. She had a kitchen maid, she had full staff, there was a housekeeper who was permanent, who stayed with the house, who was very well respected locally. So she would have been cooking all of the meals that he was putting on for entertaining. He had two houses in the Newmarket, and he owned a really good stud. So this would have been very, very prestigious stuff. Really huge meals, and every single one, of course, would have had to be absolutely magnificent. This is not just throw me together a quick toasty because I was having a snack. This is put on my 11-course meal, please.
And can you give us a flavour of what kind of things they would have been eating? So can you contextualise it in the styles you describe, with the very fussy, doesn't tip but doesn't taste that nice?
Yeah, a lot of that fussy stuff died a death. It didn't really survive the First World War, because how could it?
You looked
back, rationing, and also just, I think, realism. When you look back in from 1920 at 1913, the idea that you could do that, it just seems such a waste when half the country's dead or maimed.
Yeah.
And the 1920s, we often think of them as roaring and full of jazz and cocktails, but wherever you went in the countryside in particular, you would see displaced men who couldn't settle. The homeless problem was enormous, because you had a lot of what we would now call PTSD.
Yeah.
You had people who had lost limbs, who were disfigured, who couldn't hold down a job, who didn't feel settled within four walls. It was an enormous time. You couldn't miss the impact of the First World War. And this went on for, of course, years and years and years. And then you had the Depression that came in as well. So the food did become much more muted between the wars, and even those people who could still afford it, and there were a lot, and there were lots of new people coming on the scene in the 30s who were buying country houses, who wanted to put on parties, the food did change. There was a lot more influence from Europe. There was a lot more influence from America in particular. There was a really nasty set of composite salads that crept in. There were things like...
with fruit in.
Yeah, grapefruit and mayonnaise. Ooh. And just some of the recipes from those, you just think, really, why would anyone ever do that? This was the era where the candle salad was invented, which was, this was American as well, a banana set into a piece of pineapple with a piece of pepper as the handle, a cherry on top, and the whole thing was covered with mayonnaise.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
It sounds terrible. It looks worse. I mean, it's impossible not to look at it and start sniggering.
I was quite struck by quite a lot of the food you described. Just to me sounded really foreign and really hard to imagine how it would have tasted. And I don't know, I suppose I found that quite... I was quite surprised that that was the case. It does seem like the food we eat today, and I know obviously we're so lucky today with supermarkets and, you know, eating whatever we like, there's so much choice. But do you think that's right, that food
it's
combinations?
A mixture, I think. We have this idea that a lot of our quote-unquote traditional foods were around in the 20s and 30s, so things like bread and butter pudding and suet puddings, all those comfort foods that we sort of think are quasi-Victorian, quasi-20s, and they were, but they're very much middle-class foods. So the level that I'm describing a lot in the book is really that upper-class level, where you've still got some elements of the Edwardian period, which are quite foreign, lots of aspic, for one thing. But you've also got, especially among the people that Georgina was cooking for, a desire to show their good taste by being quite exotic. So some of the combinations that were put together do sound quite weird to us today. But then I suppose if you were in 1932 and you were looking at a quinoa salad, you'd think that was pretty odd as well. Yeah. They'd still have a go at eating it. So some of the foods are quite alien. Some of them, I think, are, they sound alien, but actually when you cook them, they're fantastic. Boodle's Orange Fool, which
that's on my list to ask you about.
So nice.
What is it? Describe it.
It's kind of, so I'm a real trifle hater. I think that soggy cake has no place on the table anywhere, and that is a hill I will die on. But Boodle's Orange Fool is like a nice trifle.
Right.
So you take sponge cake and you put it into effectively sort of boozy cream with loads of orange in. And it's really plain and simple. And it's just divine. You know, it's one of those dishes where, again, there are kind of five ingredients. And it's just absolutely beautiful. And you have it on a summer's day as the sun is starting to fade as a sweet stroke palate cleanser. And it's gorgeous.
Okay. The recipe is in the book, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I will try and make it.
It's very easy. Make your own sponge cake, though. Don't buy one.
So back to 1939. She's in Newmarket. And
yeah, so she's cooking amazing food. She's cooking very long meals. There will always be soups, normally with French names, lots of garnishes, stuff that you would recognise in the Edwardian period, but it's pared down. And she developed a style of cooking by this point that was quite pared down. It was very much more Escoffier than Agnes Marshall. It was very much more flavours that were coming to the fore, really privileging ingredients that were
seasonal.
Very, very good. Seasonal, good, yes. I mean, certainly by the 30s, there was more of a trend towards seasonality than there had perhaps been in the Victorian era, where, of course, you could force things out of season, and having things out of season was a mark of wealth. Mm. By this point, people were much more revaluing the idea of things that were seasonal, things that tasted really, really good, and everything presented with a real flourish. But, of course, this was the summer of 1939, and it was quite obvious to a lot of people that war was coming. Winston Churchill was in France in August, and they came back early because they could see that something was going to happen. They weren't sure what. And Mary Soames talked about seeing the French troops massing at the railway stations on the way back, and there was this sense of menace and of waiting,
yeah,
because something was going to happen. It
looming.
Wasn't sure what. Yes. So Georgina at this point was almost approaching retirement, but not really. She certainly had a career in front of her. She had no real dependents. Her daughter was working by this point. But she must have been conscious of what was going to happen, because it was impossible not to be. And as the war grew closer and then eventually was declared, Baron Glanley dropped everything and rushed back to Cardiff, where he had his shipping interests, and left the household. So by the start of September, Georgina was still there in Exning House, but at a loose end, presumably packing up the house with the rest of the people. Still, I presume, salaried, because she would have been taken on. She'd already lived through the First World War. She was well aware that all those employment opportunities that she had, they would disappear. No one was going to be holding debutante parties in the middle
of
a war. So from her point of view, she'd gone from being a cook right at the top of her profession. She'd cooked for all sorts of people, including the Churchills, who couldn't really afford her, but had used her for a couple of weekends to cater for them at Chartwell. But she's now faced with this enormous decision. Does she try and continue to be a jobbing cook when almost certainly those opportunities will dry up? Or does she try and find an employer and go back into permanent service for the first time since 1909?
I have to just quickly explain that we are slightly cheating with your year. It's a sort of 18-month period, isn't it, between July 1939. I hope the powers that be at Travels Through Time won't mind about this. So our next date is February the 2nd, 1940.
Yes.
And we're at Admiralty House in central London. The country is now at war. Georgie is working for the Churchills full time, so she's gone back into service. Winston has been made First Lord of the Admiralty. It's a fantastic
it's
title.
Great.
Nelson is visible on his column,
yep,
in the distance. Take us there and tell us what was happening.
Well, Georgina already had a relationship with Churchill. She'd cooked for them on at least three occasions in the 1930s and also done it on weekends. So, and some of those menus exist, so you can see what she'd cooked for them. They'd clearly valued her a lot because they'd been sort of, I mean, they used a lot of cooks from agencies. They really played about. They couldn't retain staff. It was a really rackety household. And she clearly made quite a big impression on them because they did use her repeatedly to cater events for them.
She seemed able to cope with their chaos and demand.
Yeah,
how
I mean,
demanding they were.
Churchill was he was renowned as a difficult employer.
But she seemed to be able to
I think
manage
she was very, very calm. And
yeah,
she was, no one ever had a bad word to say about her. All of the people that talked about her later on, always said she was always cheerful, in even in the face of the sort of desperate situations with really struggling to get hold of food, or Churchill deciding at the last minute that he wanted to have his meals somewhere else, which he frequently did. She always kept a smile on her face, and she always turned out exquisite food. So I think she'd worked for so many people that she'd seen, she must have been there, seen that, done it.
She must have had a really specific set of personal characteristics, though, in order to be, I mean, she must have been incredibly talented.
Yeah, and very unflappable. There are stories told of her an hour before the dinner's due to be served, sitting there with her feet up doing the racing post.
Yes.
Nothing. And when you meet professional chefs today, the good professional chefs today are unbelievably calm. I work quite regularly with a chef who teaches at Westminster Kingsway, and in it, it's amazing. You go in and it doesn't matter how many dishes are being prepared. Everything is ready. Everything is wrapped in about a million tons of cling film, and everything is clean.
The Gordon Ramsay model is not...
It's not real.
The norm.
I think it makes good television, but when you actually work with people who know what they're doing, it is so calm and collected.
Yeah.
And things just happen like magic. It's taught me an awful lot working with professionals, because it's a delight, and you come to the end of it and you just feel, no, that was fine. And it's all about the planning, the organisation, and the mise en place.
Knowing what you're doing. Yeah. Very important.
So she was very well organised, and she was, because I think she'd worked in the English idiom and the French idiom as well, she knew exactly what she was doing, and she could draw upon a huge pool of recipes. And she knew them, she knew what she was getting into. And I suspect that her decision was very simple. It was, I need a job. I need a job that's going to be decent. I need a job that's going to be challenging. I need a job that's going to be prestigious. Who, among the people I've worked for and have a relationship with, who's going to be the most likely person to get a decent position that they're going to hold on to for the duration of the war?
Do you think she actually thought like that?
I suspect she did. Because,
and did she approach them, or did they approach her?
It's very hard to know. It appears she approached them, because Clementine talks about when Georgina approached me. There's a meeting. Clementine's engagement diaries exist, and there's a meeting between them much earlier in the year where they settled on terms, and then Georgina started work with them finally on the 2nd of February. But they had this meeting in January, 5th of January, so just before rationing came in. It came in on the 8th. And Clementine later said, I was absolutely delighted when she came to work for us. I knew that she would make the most of the ration and that everyone in the household would be happy. And the subtext is, as long as Winston is fed and watered and he feels that he's getting a good dinner, he'll be able to get on with his job.
Right.
So she recognised very early on that it was crucial that his stomach was happy. I mean, he, you know, when he travelled, he used to travel on what he called tummy time and keep British time so that he wouldn't get disrupted by different flight zones. So stomach really did rule him. And for Georgina, going to work for them must have been huge relief, because this was one of only two men who'd been consistently against German appeasement. So it was quite clear he was going to get a good position in the government. Mm. First Lord of the Admiralty, obviously absolutely crucial. And then when Chamberlain's government fell, Churchill became Prime Minister. That's it. Brilliant. She's in the best job she could be in at that point in terms of job security. Because even if she'd been working for a duke or for even for the royal household, they were retrenching, they were moving, they were shutting down houses. This was something where she was working
at the centre. She was at the centre.
Can you imagine cooking for anybody more crucial at that point, or seeing more of what was going on in terms of how the world was working?
Yeah. Will you just talk a bit about, because I think one of the things that's really, really interesting in your book is this relationship between, you know, entertaining and diplomacy and networking, and how important it was for the Churchills to know that no matter who they had, Eisenhower, de Gaulle, whoever it was,
exactly. She always said she'd cooked for 14 monarchs,
but they could relax and know that whatever came out of the kitchen was going to come out on time, it was going to be exquisite. And
it's the things you don't notice that actually are the really important things. If the food had been bad, it would have ruined dinner.
But don't you think people would have noticed how good the food was? Because during the war, generally, even if you were rich...
I suspect it's one of the reasons the king came to stay quite so often with his regular meetings with Churchill, given they had really kind of obvious austerity at the palaces. And up pops George quite a lot. Hi, Winston, just coming over for lunch again. People did notice how good the food was. Winston Churchill used food quite aggressively as part of his diplomacy. He always regarded dinner table diplomacy as a kind of key plank. And so much happened, both before the war and indeed during it, around the dinner table that was never really recorded in official minutes. These sort of social glue, I suppose, all those interactions over dinner tables were really important to how relationships were formed and worked. So if you had a really good relationship with, for example, the Premier of Canada, it would be much easier to get Canadian troops to join in the war, which is exactly what happened. Georgina's cooking was crucial to that, because it was a time of rationing.
But didn't the Canadian Prime Minister send, weren't there quite a lot of friendly Canadians sending them parcels? And there's a great recipe for maple syrup.
Mousse. Yeah, it's lovely as well. Churchill didn't really know what the ration was. I mean, he had no clue.
No, he wasn't going to, patriotic as he was.
He wasn't going to live on the ration.
No.
He nominally did. He had to be seen to be doing it. That's how rationing worked. Everybody had a ration book. Everybody was entitled to the same amount of food at the set prices. No one could cheat it. And no one did, ostensibly. But of course, if you're an aristocrat and you've got a country estate, you've got unlimited game, you've got unlimited milk because you've got your herds, you've got unlimited fruit and vegetables.
Honey,
peaches.
Yeah.
Always a breakfast
the
item.
Peaches.
You know, and if you weren't an aristocrat, if you were working class, but you had an allotment, you would grow your own. So really what the aristocracy are doing is they're doing it on a bigger, much bigger scale.
Yeah.
And I think as well within the country, there was this idea that Churchill did deserve more because he was leading the country. So it's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as if there was a great resentment of what was going on in terms of what Georgina had to cook with. It wasn't the basic ration. You know, I mean, he was sent eggs. Loads of eggs from a primary school, from their hens, all with their own names on. So this massive amount of eggs arrived.
It's heartbreaking, though, to think of those poor primary school children who
didn't
probably
have an egg
living
that
on
day.
One egg every 2 weeks.
Well, it's the contrast. You find war diaries where one woman lamented that she'd got her one fresh egg that she had for that 2 weeks, and it was off, and that was it. He's got venison coming down from Balmoral because the king is sending him Balmoral venison. He's got game coming from there. And there are things, you know, even after the government stop people sending food parcels to relatives on the grounds that it's not good for morale, it's all right, because
if
you've got like the Air Force from
and
America
food is so important, isn't it?
It's absolutely so. And people's letters at the time obsess about food, about the fact they can't get hold of it.
Yeah.
And actually, the Churchill's no different. It's just that they're thanking people for sending them crates of oranges rather than saying, oh,
I'm
I
so
wish
hungry.
I could have an onion.
I haven't had an orange. Okay, so our third scene is a few months later, and now we're in Downing Street. Winston Churchill is Prime Minister. And there's a very dramatic thing that happens. Will you tell us about it, please?
I think this is the thing that really cements their relationship in some ways and certainly shows Georgie's work ethic and Winston Churchill's work ethic. So this is October the 14th, and it's right in the middle of the Blitz, and there's Blitz tourism going on. So if you read war diaries at the time, people get on the bus to go and see what's happened on Oxford Street. There's this idea of the Blitz spirit, and which I think is not... it's been overplayed. There was as much pillaging and looting and people being terrible as there were people helping each other out. And I think, you know, that's just human nature. And certainly there was a lot of, ooh, there's been a big building bombed. Let's go and have a look at the bomb site. And on the 14th of October, which was one of the heaviest nights of the Blitz, bombs fell very, very close to Downing Street itself. The Downing Street kitchen was in the basement, which a lot of kitchens were from Georgian houses, and it had this enormous plate glass window in it, both sides actually. And there's a kitchen table in front of the plate glass window, the ranges, dressers, all the rest of it. But you have to imagine this kitchen with this huge window. Georgina and her maids were preparing dinner, and the main dish they had on the go was a thing called a mousseline pudding, which was this incredibly ethereal, beautiful, it's gorgeous, light sponge pudding. And Georgina talks about this incident in the interview with her that she made in the 1970s. And she just says, well, I couldn't turn it out. I mean, it wasn't like a normal dessert. I couldn't have turned it out. It had to be done at the time. If it had been a normal one, I'd have turned it out. And apparently every night Churchill would pop his head around the kitchen door and say, the air raid shelter is downstairs. The sirens are going off. Will you go downstairs? And she'd go, yeah, in a minute. And eventually he just said, if Mr. Hitler gets you, I won't get my soup. So this had become a bit of a running gag between them.
Yeah.
Now, he wrote about this incident as well in his memoir of World War II. And of course, his version is more grandiose. So he talks about having a sudden premonition that something bad was going to happen and rushing to the kitchen where Mrs. Landemar and her maid were working without turning a hair as the bombs fell around them. And I think the truth is probably somewhere between the two. He did have to tell her every night. But on this night, he said to her, you've got to go down to the shelter. And she said, no, I've got this pudding. And he said, come on. And they all went down. And then the bomb fell sort of metres away from Downing Street. And when they came back upstairs again, this plate glass window had exploded all over the kitchen. She would have died. And she said she owed him her life. But actually, she was just as worried about the fact that the table was covered with rubble. Well, and of course, so the mousseline pudding was ruined.
Well, yeah, exactly. What happened to the mousseline pudding?
But I think it does show the bond that they had and the bond that was very, very real. He very much valued her skills, but also valued her personally. And when there was a document drawn up in 1940, which gave a list of all the people that would be taken out of London with Churchill in the event of an invasion, and only two domestic staff were named. So Georgina and Winston Churchill's valet, Frank Sawyers. So the fact that she was so important that she would have been taken out of London with him to cook for him when they got whisked away to some unknown location shows how crucial she was to that household.
Yeah. And of course they were living together. I think that's another thing.
Yeah. Well, she was upstairs at Downing Street.
The upstairs, downstairs. Yeah. You know, they're all together in the same house.
And even after they built the annex, which they did after the bomb incident, they built a sort of extra apartment, bomb-proof apartment, just over the road. Even when they built that, she moved... she probably had rooms there or was sleeping in the kitchen, or possibly she was still at Downing Street, but they were all very close. This was very much cheek by jowl living. The respect they had for each other was very, very clear from that incident, and then it just grew and grew and grew. And she ended up cooking for the Churchills for over 15 years, all told, because she retired and then kept coming back again. She was their longest serving domestic servant, and they were her longest serving employers actually as well. So that relationship, you know, that's a long time to be living alongside each other, yeah. Knowing each other's tastes, knowing each other's secrets. She used to talk about, you know, constantly seeing him streak naked through the house. Oh no, here's Winston again. Put a towel on. So this really was, they were so close. And as close as well to Clementine Churchill, who was really, really key.
Well, and they stayed in touch, didn't they? Mm. She stayed in touch with all of them.
She really missed them. She really struggled when she retired. So she retired through ill health, really, when she was in her 70s. In 1955, and then again in 1956, she just kept sort of coming back and retiring, and eventually she did go, but she really struggled to adjust. She lived with her brother Algie for a while, and then she moved into a granny flat with Yvonne and Ted, who was Yvonne's husband, her daughter and her son-in-law. But she wrote to the family, she stayed in contact. Clementine used to visit her quite regularly. She'd cook a chocolate cake for Clementine's visits. When the series The Valiant Years aired on television, Clementine rang up and said, "I've got a colour television that the television series have given me. Do you want it?" And Georgina said, "Yeah, that'd be brilliant, amazing." Went downstairs and said to her daughter, "Great, we're going to be given this colour television." And her daughter went, "Yeah, but not today, Mum, because this is Labour HQ for the local council elections and it's covered with a sea of red." So, you know, they did stay in touch, and they were genuinely close, to the point that when Clementine was dying in 1977, at the end of 1977, she didn't send out Christmas cards that year mainly, but she did send one to Georgina, which still exists. So there's a very small family archive and the card's there. And Eddie, who's Georgina's granddaughter, says she was there as Georgina opened this card and cried. So even I am welling up, because you get so close to your characters. She cried as she opened this card, knowing that Clementine had died. And she got the card after her death, and that finished her, and she died herself sort of 4 months later. So
did she?
They were just, it's a beautiful story in some ways of a woman who, in her own words, devoted her life to service, but felt that she got back as much as she gave, and that the relationships that she forged with people who were among the most important of their day made everything that she'd done worthwhile. So she thought her life worth celebrating. And I think it's worth celebrating, which is, I think, one of the reasons I'm so proud of what I've done with the book.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, she was a really, really, as you say, really talented, successful woman who played a really, really important role in Winston Churchill's life and his family.
And yet she's, you know, you read books about him and there might be two references to her. One, which is usually the bomb incident, and the other one is the fact that on VE Day, he turned to her. She'd struggled up from the basement and sort of just made it for the end of his speech. And he turned to her, broke away from the crowd and shook her hand and said, "I couldn't have won the war without you."
No,
and you just think...
all that food, you know, all those meals, all the beef.
She's just... and the food is fantastic. When you cook her recipes, they are so good.
Are they?
So good.
Maybe you should reissue a cookbook.
Well, the Imperial War Museum has issued a cut-down version. It's a sort of slightly abridged version of recipes from number 10. So the recipes are in there. They're quite hard to cook unless you know what you're doing. And that was said in reviews at the time, was right. That it was very much for a professional cook because they're quite sparse in terms of the prose. But they are absolutely fantastic.
A bit like on the Bake Off when they have the technical...
Yes. Working from Georgina's recipes would be quite a lot like that. But they are really, really good.
Well, I've just got one more question that I want to ask you, and that is if you could choose something to bring back with you from the year 1939-1940.
In some ways it's sort of pots and pans and things she used, but actually some of those still exist, and they're in the Churchill War Room's kitchen because her granddaughter had some of them and had sort of put them on permanent display. I think I'd have to choose one of the menu books, the books that give the details of what people were eating. In theory, there's probably a staff menu book and a family menu book, so I'd like to be sneaky and bring back both of them, just so I can see what she actually was cooking, because there are diary entries that detail the kind of meals people had. Mary Soames in particular, her diaries are beautiful to read. She's such a joy. She's a teenager when the war breaks out, and they're just, you know, you're reading them and giggling and really living with it, the kind of highs and lows of teenage life. So she details the food that she was eating, and there are people that visit, but there's no clear picture of what was being eaten on a daily basis.
Right.
So I'd bring back the menu books that have disappeared.
And would those menu books include who was coming for dinner on that night?
Of the time they do. Some of the earlier ones don't, but some of the time they do, especially when Professor Lindemann, who was one of the advisors when he was coming to dinner, because he was vegetarian and only ate white food. So you can tell when he's there, because suddenly everything's very bland, a lot
and
of egg.
Spaghetti.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. That was absolutely fascinating.
Thank you very much.
That was me, Violet Moller, talking to Dr. Annie Gray the other day about the fascinating Georgina Landemar. Annie's book, Victory in the Kitchen, is available now in all good bookshops, and it's published by Profile Books.
Hello, I'm John Hillman, one of the producers on the Travels Through Time podcast. I hope you enjoyed Violet's conversation with Dr. Annie Gray about Churchill's cook in the year 1940. Now, if you head over to our website, tttpodcast.com, you'll find loads more to explore from this era. We have Andrew Roberts discussing Churchill in 1940, but if you wish to continue exploring the culinary theme, you'll also find a fascinating episode featuring Thomas Harding with an incredibly interesting story about the Lion's Tea Company and its confrontation with Britain's 1930s fascist leader, Oswald Mosley. You'll also find many other fascinating adventures into the past from across the centuries, and I'm sure there's something there for you to enjoy. So once again, thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to welcoming you back very soon.